Hey everyone, this is the Helping Friendly Podcast. This is RJ. I'm here with Matt. Hi, Matt.
Hey, man.
And we are here with Ben Greenfield, first time guest, long time Twitter engager. Hey, Ben.
Hey. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah. And Ben, you can share your, what's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is Guy Forget, OPT. It's spelled just how it sounds. that's all you need to know.
we've been tweeting for a long time, and tonight's topic, this episode, we'll talk about it a little bit. I think it started with a Twitter back and forth, but really enjoy your perspective on fish and your contributions. So it's good to finally at least see your face.
Yeah.
And besides the OPT, which stands for Online Fish Tour, right?
Yes, yes. So, yeah, Online Fish Tour is a site that was started, I think, back around when the band came back in 2009 or 2010 by a fellow who goes by the name of Rory, and I joined, I guess, within a year or so of that, and have intermittently written for it here and there.
Awesome. So besides on the OPT where you can find Ben, Ben also created a series of awesome mashups that went up onto YouTube a few years ago. We were talking about one a couple minutes ago, this mashup of James Brown playing in Zaire with Fish, the Roses Jam from April 3rd, 98 on the Island Tour, which is, I'm not joking, I probably have the stats to back this up, it's probably one of my top five most viewed videos ever on YouTube. Because you take two things that are like amazing, James Brown and Fish, plus you're talking about top tier performances from both. If you've never seen the film about James Brown going to Zaire, I think it's, I can't remember what it's called. Do you remember the name of it, Ben?
I don't.
The actual movie. It's about James Brown going to play in Zaire the night before the Rumble in the Jungle. They had this concert at the stadium where they were having the boxing match. And James Brown comes out and does the Payback. And the build up to this thing, he walks out. And first off, it's mustache era James Brown, which is like the best James Brown. He's got the most ridiculous outfit you've ever imagined in your entire life. He comes out and he does like a karate spin, split, kick the mic move straight into singing the Payback, which is like one of the greatest, most funky things you've ever seen in your entire life. And Ben managed to take that and jam the funk part of the Island Tour Roses in there somehow. And it's pretty awesome. So if you haven't seen that before, go check that out, because I guarantee you, you'll be as hooked as I am on that.
Thanks for the plug. Yeah, they happen to have extraordinarily similar grooves. And so, you know, that was half the fun. And then the other half of the fun is just seeing James Brown dance to the 4398 Roses, which is something you can do if you watch the video.
Yeah, we'll link to it in the show notes. So if you look in your show notes, you'll see the link. So yeah, and actually, it's interesting because we were part of a conversation with you, Ben, a couple of weeks ago on Twitter about Trey's playing and about where Fish is now, and I'm hoping that comes up in the discussion of this sort of topic, because we're going to span kind of the whole era of Fish, and so I want to get your take because I have some specific questions, because we kind of left it hanging on Twitter, but we'll get into that.
Yeah,
and not to.
Yeah, bring it. You know, let's get into it.
Let's get into it. So, not to spoil it for everyone, but the topic, as you've probably seen already in your show notes, is we're talking about great first sets, which is just an interesting and very overwhelming topic. And we're gonna talk a little bit about years, you know, from 93 onward, really. So we'll get into a lot of Fish discussion. But Ben, before we start, how did your Fish journey start? Tell us about how you got into the band and sort of how you've evolved as a fan.
Yeah, well, so my intro to the band is probably like the most cliched intro ever, I guess. It was the summer of 92. I was a wee 10-year-old at summer camp, and my counselor played, I guess they were mostly playing Picture of Nectar and Lawn Boy in the bunk. And a bunch of kids in the bunk like really got into Cavern and really got into Antelope, although we thought, we were sure that they were singing Run Like an Animal out of control, so we were singing that all the time. And, you know, I was into it. And so I asked my sister to, I told my sister I really liked it, and she got me a picture of Nectar for a birthday present that summer. And, yeah, so I was an 11-year-old listening to Phish. I guess I can be proud of that. And then I first saw them
nice.
In 96, and the rest is history.
Awesome. And that was where'd you grow up? In East Coast or in West?
In Philadelphia. Yeah, Matt okay. and I were unknowing neighbors.
Oh, yeah, wow. See, I needed to know you because I had nobody that gave me that influence when I was growing up and didn't get into the band later. I could have we could have had our parents drop us off at the Spectrum together or something.
I know, man. What a missed opportunity.
Yeah, so the summer camp fandom is thousands of fans have gotten introduced that way.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. It's cool network though, and like mostly in the Northeast, right? From what I've heard.
Yeah, well, I think there's a whole. I feel like the concentration of summer camps in this country is definitely densest in the Northeast. Yeah, but yeah, I have a handful of friends from camp who I still occasionally go to shows with or at least talk about Phish with, and it's still a cool little community.
Nice, that's great. And so how did that evolve over time? I mean, did you see them straight through the few eras and wait out the hiatuses and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I never really stopped seeing them, but I guess I was in college. I got to college right before the hiatus, so that was a bummer. But then 2.0 was kind of right in the middle of my college career, so I was seeing a ton of shows then, and then and then I graduated and finally had some disposable income, and they broke up, and that was another bummer. but yeah, I mean, I was definitely one of those people who was still fully into it for all those intervening years.
Nice. Is this about the same timing as you, right, Matt?
Yeah, I think we're probably the same age. Were you born in 82?
In 81, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So we're just about the same age. So yeah, same. My first semester of college was when they announced the hiatus and then broke up. I was like, this is all the worst timing ever.
Yeah, I feel your pain.
And here we are. Yeah. It's pretty amazing. And we'll talk more about that just as we go through this kind of journey over the years. But Ben, the topic of today is kind of identifying some great first sets over the course of Phish's history, which when we proposed the topic, it seemed like it was something we could tackle and discuss. But then, at least for me, once I got into it, I was like, oh man, this is way harder than I thought it was going to be. So I don't know. What's your take on the kind of the topic and how you thought about it?
Yeah, it's strange because I feel like fans' relationship to first sets has been kind of a funny thing to observe, especially in 3.0, because I think for a lot of this current era, there was a lot of complaining about, the band's not jamming in the first set, or they're playing too many new songs in the first set, or whatever it is. And I think one of the things, especially as part of like the exercise of preparing for this episode, one of the things that's really interesting is that when you go back and look at it, for most of the band's history, they really haven't jammed much of the band's history, they didn't jam in the first set. You look at like any 95 first set and then anything before that too, you're not going to find any kind of like real type 2 exploration. And it's not until later that even became a thing. And then it kind of became sort of on and off ever since then.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I've identified some themes, which I want to throw out there and see what you guys think as we get into it. But yeah, sort of a philosophical question of like, what's the point of a set one? Not even just for Phish, but beyond Phish, for any band that plays two sets, Back to the Dead and before them even with other live music. It is, or I think it probably started with, it's more of a getting comfortable and getting used to the venue and the sound and the whatever. I don't know, Matt, is that your perspective, like that it is a warm up, or that's how it's traditionally viewed, and then the second set is like where the magic happens?
I feel like it is. I mean, that was kind of how I was introduced to the band, was like the first set is like the songy kind of thing. And, you know, everybody gets settled in and stuff like that. And that set two is where the real psychedelic stuff happens. And I have to agree. I mean, Ben, maybe we can, share your chart that you created too, which shows the number of 20 minute jams, in the first set per year, I guess. It's really, like you were right, it's like a concentrated section in the late 90s. And then, of course, in like probably 2004, when they were just, you know, jamming like everything really, really long and not playing as many songs in general. But I don't know. I often don't get the complaints that people have about the first set. I think maybe it's just because that has been my understanding of the structure of the show. And maybe... I think for the same reason that people started to think, you know, when they came back in 3.0, like they're not jamming everything to be 30 minutes long. So it's not the real fish. It's like, well, no, look back through their history. And they haven't done that during, you know, long periods of time in the first or second set. I mean, people obviously got turned on to the band like you did, Ben, in the early 90s when they really weren't jamming much of anything. I mean, it wasn't until, you know, basically 10 years into their career that the whole long form exploration jamming happened. And then, you know, you have a section in the 90s and beyond where they start jamming a lot more. So that kind of became the expectation, I feel like. But I don't mind if I go to a show, settling in and having the first set to, you know, hear a bunch of those shorter songs, which I like as well. And, you know, getting comfortable, having fun, and then, you know, having expectations for the second set that things are going to start to get weird at that point.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's all true, and another thing that's true is that, you know, I mean, I think it's easy to see fish in terms of like the binary, like on one hand you have huge exploratory jams, and then on the other hand you just have songs. But then there's also so many other things that they can do, and I think that first sets for a lot of their history have really shown off some of their other strengths, whether that be, you know, killer guitar solos, or, you know, some antics, some segues, or if it's just, you know, playing songs that they didn't play last night. You know, I mean, every first set is still different from the previous show's first set and from every other first set that they've ever played, which is, you know, which is easy to lose sight of, but it's something that makes every single one creative in its own way.
Yeah, and I think for all of us, our favorite shows are usually based on the second sets, right? It's like, I mean, maybe it can like form a package around the second set. You know, the first set's like, yeah, they have a couple of good things, or, you know, they close with a great antelope or whatever. But it's interesting. That's going back to your chart, Ben. I think it identified like 27 jams total that were over 20 minutes in the first set ever, which is just amazing given how many years they've played. So that's like, that's pretty rare that they were, and they, like Matt said, they're kind of all concentrated. So it's, yeah, I guess fans have got used to that idea of just kind of like you settle in. If there's like one 10 minute song, whether it's Bathtub Gin or Maze or Antelope or whatever, then you're in good shape. Right.
Yeah.
Well, and then how about, how about this as well? I'm always a fan of balance and the yin and the yang, or the sweet and the sour. So how cool is it when you do get a big jam in the first set, or even to open up a show? It wouldn't be as exciting if that happened every night. Like if you expected them to step on stage at 8 o'clock every night and play for 25 minutes, then it wouldn't be as cool when they come out and they do that. And it's like, that to me, when that kind of stuff happens, it's like, all right, they're here to play. I mean, they're really trying to tip us off early, like buckle yourselves in, because it's going to get crazy tonight.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, like, I would love to hear the band's take on this, because, you know, I do think that there's probably a sizable portion of the audience that would probably love it if the band would play a 20-minute jam in every first set, and yet, like, for most of their history, the band has just chosen not to do that. Like, they could if they wanted to, but yeah, they clearly see some value you know, I mean, Trey loves playing his songs, and they love doing stuff that isn't exploratory jamming.
Yeah. And I think there's a few trends that I saw just looking through these like great first sets. There's a couple that were like tour closers, you know, where they're getting close to the end and they were just kind of locked in and having fun. And so the whole show was great, including from the first set. But there's also some that are just like middle of a tour in the middle of the country and just, you know, there's no real magic formula. But well, we can get into that a little bit. It's interesting because the last, chronologically, the last first set that I thought of, and then we added one after the New Year's run, but the Back to the Lawn Boy, which is like the second podcast episode that we've done since Baker's Dozen, that includes something about the Lawn Boy being really important and interesting. And I don't know, we'll get there, but I don't know, that's sort of changed perspectives again, right? At least for me, I think now that could happen anytime. What do you guys think? Could it happen? Are we back to like now? Did they reset the whole understanding of it with Baker's Dozen, or was that like a one-off and this summer at Meriwether we'll just get like regular first sets again?
Yeah, I guess we'll find out. I mean, I think, you know, maybe MSG, maybe the holiday run provided some indication, but I think to a large extent, we still don't know what the impact of the Baker's Dozen on their long-term approach to, you know, to playing shows is going to be. But yeah, that certainly did, that show, that jam-filled show felt like something different in the same way that the entire Baker's Dozen felt like something not really like anything they've done before. And you certainly could imagine it having some big impact long term.
I would add on to the last thing I said, which is to me, the jam night was so great for everybody, not even necessarily because the music that they played, which was fantastic. I don't think it was the best part of that run personally, but I think it was sort of to a certain extent shock value for part of it. Like, you know, Lawn Boy and Sample in a Jar, the whole thing being that like they open up with Sample in a Jar on a night that people are expecting them to jam based on the donut flavor. And it was like, wait a minute, you're going to play Sample in a Jar? And then they say, aha, we're going to jam Sample in a Jar and it's going to get crazy. Now we're going to play Lawn Boy and we're going to jam that. So there's a certain amount of just kind of elation just over the fact that they're going long on those songs to begin with. So I don't know. Maybe it was you know, a gimmick. Maybe it's something that they'll keep doing occasionally.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess the one thing I'd say before we get into the specific shows we wanted to highlight is that this is just really scratching the surface. I think we all went into this like looking for whatever we could find, but then also acknowledging that there's probably some stuff that people listening might identify that we didn't. So add us. You know, tell us what we missed, and let's keep talking about this, because this is a starting point, I think, right? Not a definitive list, but I hope we can show some sets maybe that people haven't gone back to in a while that people might want to. So let's get in first. So there is, I think you mentioned, Ben, like there's, you know, pre sort of 95, pre 97, really, it's like hard to look and identify really great first sets. We identified a couple, I think, sort of all, a few of us did. Starting, there were some good shows in 92, of course, but those first sets were, I think, like really well played and pretty similar a lot of the time. So one of the ones that we picked out here was May 8th, 93, Durham, New Hampshire, which was the end of the, I think Trey said it was a 71 show tour, and this was the last show of the tour. He said that, like, you know, in the middle of the first set. Pretty amazing that's a huge tour for them, and it's only May and they've already played 71 shows. But this is sort of a classic show, right? It was one of the first tapes that I had. I don't know if you guys had this tape or listened to this show early on, but it's highly circulated and then ended up being a Live Fish release.
Yeah, and this is one of those shows that, I mean, I think this is what you were saying, where, you know, you just feel that the band has really gelled by the end of the tour. They're just absolutely firing on all cylinders, and also probably, you know, feeling something a little bit special in the air because it's the last night of the tour. And so you see some special set list stuff, but also special playing going on in both sets one and two.
Yeah. Did you grow up listening to this? Was this something you had?
This actually, for whatever reason, I don't think this made it into my XL2 collection for quite a while. So Yeah, I think I was more focused on collecting August 93 when I was collecting tapes.
Yeah, it's good stuff. The field house is like, you know, UNH, it's a sort of basketball arena at University of New Hampshire. So I don't know, you know, back Brad and I just talked about a 93 show last night for HF Pod Plus, and, you know, we have no idea because this might be a little bit better, like in terms of intel, but, you know, 4,000 capacity field house, I don't know, at 93 could have been full, could have been empty. I have no idea, you know, I don't know many people who were there.
Yeah, New Hampshire was probably one of the only places that they could play to a big crowd at that point. And it was the end of the tour, sort of probably a little bit of a homecoming show. So, and they had sold out, you know, I think bigger shows than that by that point, in Boston and kind of up in New England. So, probably a good sized crowd. But to get back to the music, the crazy thing is that you guys mentioned this, and my mind immediately went to the second set, which is really, really wild. There's that like crazy Bowie and a crazy Mike's Groove and in and out of all sorts of different covers and big ball jam and stuff. And I was scratching my head a little bit thinking about it. And it was then I had to kind of remember, oh, yeah, this is that amazing stash that gets a lot of attention. But you're right, too. I mean, like a little bit extra energy throughout. And like I was saying before, you know, this doesn't accomplish it with a 20-minute jam, but playing at a level that tells you that it's going to be a great night because they're on from the second that they take the stage.
Right. Yeah. I think you could probably make the argument that without that stash into Kung into stash, that, you know, this probably wouldn't be we probably wouldn't be talking about this in this particular episode about this set. But that stash Kung stash is amazing, and it's absolutely essential listening, and the playing is great throughout. I also that Satin Doll towards the end of the set with the little Trey speech that you were mentioning, RJ. It's all worth hearing, even if you know, the fireworks in the second set are arguably bigger fireworks.
Ever a rail we curl, be ever so voracious.
And this is one of those shows that you like, you might just go to the second set because it's so interesting and so many segues and all that stuff, as Matt mentioned. But yeah, so, and the great Reba too. People should definitely check it out. That's one of the trends that I noticed, at least in the stuff that we were choosing, a lot of Rebas in the first sets of, you know, good first sets, which is just fine with me, you know, more Rebas, the better. This is a good era for Reba.
Yeah, I guess we also, maybe this is a segue into our next one, but there's also a lot of Kungs.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so do you want to talk about the next one, Ben?
Yeah, well, so the next one was October 21st, 1995, which I guess is, that's towards the earlier end of the Fall 95 tour, although it's mm-hmm. it's another one of these just months-long tours. It's hard to imagine being in the audience's shoes as the first notes of this show start up, and you think maybe the band is opening with Tweezer, but actually it turns out they're opening with Tweezer Reprise. Mm-hmm. And this was the first time that Tweezer Reprise had ever appeared in a show without a Tweezer, and then later in the set was the second time that a Tweezer Reprise had ever appeared in a show without a Tweezer, because the set is kind of bookended with these things, and people might know this, but the set ends with a jam out of Good Times, Bad Times, and the band somehow finds a way to go absolutely seamlessly back into Tweezer Reprise in a different key, I might add. And it's just one of the coolest segues, I think, in all of Phish history, in my opinion.
Yeah, so tell us about just in terms of like the different key. I mean, what do you think transpired? I mean, it's like Trey was just loving playing Tweezer Reprise, so he just went like, it's like, we're going to play it no matter what, even though it's not even the same way we usually play it.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and one we'll never know the answer to. But I think the one clue about, you know, whether this was planned or not for them to go back into it is the fact that if you go to like the very last notes, so you know how at the end of a Tweezer Reprise, at the very end of it, Trey plays the lick one more time at the end after he's been mm-hmm. playing that ascending riff. So they're in a different key, and Trey tries to play that final version of the lick, and he messes it up. He plays it in the wrong key, yeah. Which to me suggests that maybe they weren't planning it. So, you know, the fuck up reveals all.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the other thing that I think of, which, you know, besides obviously that amazing segue, which I agree is one of the best that they've ever done, as I look at this and look at the last first set that we were talking about from New Hampshire, and probably this will come up with some of the other shows, it seems like another one of these tenets of great first sets appears to be things that you would expect in the second set happening, right? So, or even in this, you know, the encore for the Tweet Prize case, Acoustic Army is another a good example here, mostly played in the second set. I think, you know, probably 70% of them or so were played in the second set. So a little strange to have it in first set, but another one of those kind of indications that that things are going to get, you know, be really great from the start. Kung, I didn't run the numbers on. I feel like that's maybe a little bit more evenly split, but probably a little bit leaning towards second set coming out of some crazy jams. So just another kind of indicator that things are non-standard and you should buckle in.
Yeah, another live fish release here, which is interesting. And maybe we're just, you know, we notice these things because we've heard the better sounding versions of them. But Saturday night in the middle of a tour in Nebraska, to be fair, it's like, you know, college town, right? So maybe they're having fun being in a college town. But it's just weird that it's like middle of the tour, middle of the country, and, you know, get this kind of pretty stellar start to a show. And they weren't like finishing the tweezer from the night before. It was just completely disconnected.
Yeah, it's you can imagine maybe that leading up to Halloween, that maybe there was some kind of special energy coming into the air. They kind of play around with, there was anticipation that maybe they were going to play Michael Jackson for Halloween. And so they kind of play around with that at some point in the set. Mm-hmm. Clearly those guys were really having some fun on this tour. See a lot of shenanigans like that cropping up here and there.
Yeah, and you mentioned, Ben, I think in your notes for the 93 show that we talked about earlier, it is these good first sets, at least up to this point, were more notable for shenanigans and other things, not necessarily like huge jams, right? I mean, like the Reba and both of those were, I thought, great, but that's not what most people would consider a huge jam.
Right, yeah. So we still, at this point in fish history, October of 95, we're still almost 2 years away from the first 20-minute first set jam.
Which is pretty wild. So that made the list, obviously the first one, because it was a big one. So we're hopping from fall 95 to summer 97 Europe. Again, another live fish release. So that's at least something, but also the entrance of the first set ghost jam, right? Because there's so many that made our list, but Amsterdam, I mean, the whole run is just crazy. But I don't know, Ben, what was your take going back to revisit this set?
Oh my gosh. I mean, Amsterdam 97, this is the beginning of this two-night run, which the band released a couple of years ago. And yeah, I mean, just from the beginning, it's just like crazy. I, you know, who knows what the band was up to while they were in Amsterdam and, you know, where everything is legal, but man, does it come out in the music. And I think, you know, for anyone who hasn't spent a lot of time with this particular tour, the summer 97 Europe tour, I really highly recommend digging out some of those shows. Shows like 625 and 7-9 and 7-10 and almost everything in between. There's just there's some really crazy, weird, just incredibly loose playing. You know, where kind of anything goes, and they're just throwing out the rule book that they had followed even earlier that year in the February Europe tour. And you can see it right here in this first set that, you know, they come out right at the beginning of this run and just play an enormous jam. And it's an incredible jam. I mean, it still holds up, I think, as, you know, one of the great ghosts of all time.
Yeah. And we did a long discussion about June 97. That was an HF Pod Plus app, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right, RJ? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it almost felt criminal to cut everything off at June 30th because we were right on the cusp of this amazing two-night run. But yes, I mean, then you have the first 20-minute jam in a first set in the show opening Ghost. And you also have the introduction of sort of the theme for the two nights, which is the back of the worm. I agree. I think, you know, there was something environmental going on that was kind of urging them to get weird early into to kind of set the scene. You know, once again, not that this is not just going to be an amazing show, but this is going to be an exciting two nights, and we've got ideas. We have thoughts about what we're going to do, and we're going to throw this idea of the back of the worm at you, and we're not even going to explain it until the next night. We're gonna leave it dangling above your heads, and you're gonna say, what was he talking about with the worm? And then it's gonna turn out to be even freakier than you ever thought that it could be. Yeah, it's amazing. I think you know you are. You're on the back of the world. I think you know you are.
I feel like there must be something so surreal. I mean, because obviously, probably most people know this, but you know, it came out that the Trey was apparently, you know, ingesting some kind of extracurricular substances the night before, and had a vision that he was riding on the back of the worm through the sewer systems in Amsterdam. And I think the thing that was just so surreal to me is just years later seeing somebody with some kind of back of the worm t-shirt and thinking about like how weird it must be to be Trey, to, you know, to trip out one time and then see somebody with a shirt on with a reference to something you saw during your trip. It's weird.
That's true. Yeah, I didn't thought about that, but that is pretty weird. And it's almost unfair to these other first sets that, you know, open up with a 20 whatever minute ghost that happens to be one of the best ghosts they've ever played, and, you know, kind of puts a lot of other first sets at a disadvantage.
It's occurring to me too that as I look down this list, and I don't want to spoil everything, but ghost is going to start to become a theme, and still is one that if they're gonna throw something big in the first set, seems to be a go to. I'm thinking of the Dix run from a couple years ago, you know, when they opened up mm-hmm. the entire run with Ghost. Mm-hmm. So that seems to be one of the songs that is a little bit more of a switch hitter than anything else. You know, like Reba is, for as deep as it goes, tends to be a first set thing, as with Antelope. Tweezer's probably going to be a second set thing. But Ghost could kind of go either way and did mm-hmm. Many times.
Yeah, Ben, you mentioned that in terms of correlation or causation.
Right. Yeah. Well, because this was right around the time. So this was right around the debut of Ghost, and this is the debut of the 20-minute first set jam. So can you say that Ghost caused first set jams to become a thing, or is it just that whatever made the band start jamming like crazy in first sets also caused them to write a song like Ghost? We'll never know.
Yeah. I also, the other thing that I think we talked about a little bit on our fall 97 discussion, and this is maybe a lead into the next show, is particularly with a lot of the fall 97 shows, and this November 17th, the famous McNichols show, which is our next amazing first set. It feels to me like, and I don't want to suppose too many things about what was going on backstage, but like maybe the band had a lot of energy when they were walking on stage, and that they needed to get out. And so it was like, you know, let's come out there and play Tweezer right away. Let's do Tweezer. We got to do Tweezer. And of course, it was an amazing, you know, first set Ghost in that one too. But this, if you look at Ben's chart, this is the point at which you start to get a lot more of those first sets with 20-minute jams and a lot more interesting things that, you know, maybe they weren't easing into the night. They'd already gotten their easing in done, and they were ready to go from the first note at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, as we probably all know from, you know, from all of our recent revisitings of Fall 97, that those first sets are just, I mean, even comparing them to some of these other eras that we're about to get to when they were jamming a lot in the first set, like that was one of the great things that made Fall 97 so great, is that first sets, you know, had these huge jams, but they also had these amazing shorter jams too. You know, really anything could happen. And I think it's part of why those shows tend to be so amazing.
Yeah, this, I mean, I think where our conversation started about first sets was post, you know, Lawn Boy, jam filled night. And my mind automatically goes to this set. This is probably the first set that I've listened to the most of any first set ever, just because the Ghost is one of my favorite jams of all time. But the five song second set, I remember having it on tape, and like, it's cool when you could like write on one side of the tape, like two or three songs really big, because it, you know, like you had your two side tape with only five songs. Like that was a pretty cool, and it became less rare in the 97, 98 years. But before that, it was like, you know, it's a real treat to throw something on like that. So good. And yeah, always like still so good, but the Ghost kind of, you know, takes over this, although the Tweezer opener is very good too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost a flawless set front to back, except for Train Song, which Paige completely butchers, and it's unforgivable and kind of ruins the rest of the set. But yeah, this, I mean, I think you could also, I don't know, I haven't really thought about this, so someone's probably going to tell me that I'm dead wrong about it. But this is, I think this may be the first show, maybe in Phish history, where the first set is actually better than the second set. Mm-hmm. Like unquestionably, even though the second set of this show is also really, really phenomenal. But the first set is just, I mean, it's one of the great sets of all time, I think.
I think you're right. I totally agree with that. I think, then I just want to combine it with the next show, because another historic first set, which I happened to be at, which was Dayton 97, and in the 20th anniversary revisiting, I saw a few people, including my friend Craig, who has been on the podcast, mentioned maybe it was Klushko, who's always, you know, doing ranking things. One of them said, like, the first set overshadows a fairly pedestrian second set. And that is what makes Dayton 97, like, maybe slightly overrated in the whole grand scheme of things. But I kind of view them similarly, you know, to this Denver show. First sets are amazing. Second set's not quite as amazing, although this Denver one's probably better than the Dayton one.
Denver's pretty amazing, but I think it's clear with Dayton that the first set's better. Denver, it's maybe a little bit more of a personal taste kind of thing. I think the first set's better, if for no other reason than the tweezer's probably a top three tweezer for me. It's
nice,
amazing tweezer.
So maybe we're missing something. People can tell us if we're missing something in terms of first sets between Denver and Dayton, but those were the two that kind of stuck out for Fall 97, right? There's a lot of good first sets because, like, they're just killing it, but those two stood out. Is there anything else on that tour that we overlooked, guys? Ben?
Well, I have a bias towards Hampton Night 2, 11/22, because that was the first, my first two tapes were 11/21 and 11/22, and I threw on 11/22 first. I might see it through rose-colored glasses, but that, I think that first set is pretty darn cool too. You've got the unbelievable Week of Pog, which is the cap to maybe the first Mike's opener ever. Am I making that up?
That's a good question.
And then there's the Hood in there. There's Isabella. It's a great set. But I think I would probably agree with you that it's not quite on the level of Denver or Dayton.
Matt, what about you? Do these two stand out as the two sort of representative first sets for Fall 97?
Yeah, I think so. Although there are so many other great ones. The only other one that's maybe worth mentioning is the Sneak and Sally opener over the New Year's run, which is one of our other sort of categories of great first set things, a shocking bust out to open up the whole show. But the rest of that, I feel like the rest of that first set is a little bit kind of standard. I mean, for me, it's mostly about these two.
And I would just say that in the second set of Dayton, just in defense of that second set, they did play the first Boogie On since 1988. So that's something, but maybe that doesn't, it's not a great second set, but everyone knows the Tube and the Psycho Killer and everything else in that first set. It's just tremendous, tremendous show. So we jump now to summer 98, back to Europe. One of the best ghosts, right? I mean, this one I can't get enough of. It's insane. It's an insane ghost. Ben, is this one high on your list?
Yeah, it's, it's hard to think of many jams in all of Phish history that are just more, that have like more balls to the wall energy. I mean, the other one that immediately comes to mind is the 12/2/95 tweezer, which just like floors it and does not let up until the jam is over. But this ghost, I mean, everyone's probably seen that video, and Trey is just absolutely, his head looks like it's going to fly right off of his neck. It's so good. And then the rest of the set is great too. I mean, the segue into Cities, the Maze, which, you know, I almost don't want to spoil it. So if you haven't heard the Maze before, then cover your ears for the next 10 seconds. But in the middle of the Maze jam, they're just like jamming the hell out of Maze. And then all of a sudden they just stop. And then Trey like quietly thanks the audience for coming out. And then they go right back into the Maze jam. It's all just so great. I mean, the band is just at the height of their powers and they're cocky and they know how good it is. And it's just a joy.
Yeah. Yeah. I work out to this Buried Alive AC/DC bag Ghost Cities segment. Which is probably something we should do a whole separate episode on, about these crazy, crazy energized jams that, like, I put this one on and sometimes I have to apologize to my elliptical afterwards. I'm like, I'm sorry that I did that to you. And I've caught myself, like, we have a mirror in this bedroom where our elliptical is, and I've caught myself occasionally just like headbanging during the peak of the solo. And I know every note of that guitar solo. I could hum the entire thing for you. And, you know, as we just, you know, I mentioned a couple minutes ago, maybe, you know, they came out on stage with a lot of energy to burn off. And that's kind of what you're saying, because things do mellow out a little bit more until you get to the Maze. But yeah, man, that's an all time amazing segment. Listen for, if you haven't listened to this carefully, one of my favorite little Easter egg moments in the entire sequence is, if you listen very, very carefully, the segue from an AC/DC bag into Ghost is really awesome. And this is one of the first Ghosts with the new style groove that they had developed for it, which is, you know, eventually how they would wind up playing it forever. And as Mike is kind of modulating the bass line to turn it into the Ghost bass line, once he nails it and plays it successfully the first time, you can hear Trey off mic yell, he goes, "Yeah!" like to Mike, like when they stick it, like, "Yeah, we got it. All right, we're into Ghost." Like, I have a feeling they probably talked about this segue before they came out, but it's so perfectly executed and leads into that just fiery, fiery, fiery jam.
It's a great set, and like part of a great tour. You know, they were having fun, but you mentioned this earlier with the summer 97 Europe show, Ben, just really loose. Like, you know, this was obviously they were very energized for this show, but just a lot of the playing just kind of helped them just seem more relaxed. Do you think that was like, we talked about that before, the pressure of, you know, the U.S. tour and infrastructure and all that. You go to Europe, everything's smaller, a little bit more chill.
Yeah, that's certainly how it seems. You know, it always feels like, I mean, this is, it feels with Phish like their sound is totally dependent on where they're playing. I mean, I've always felt like Festival Phish just sounds qualitatively different from Arena Phish. And I think the same thing is true of when they're in the rooms. And I think it's just amplified that much more by the fact that, you know, they're traveling throughout these incredible cities. I mean, this show is in Prague, which is, you know, I mean, you have to imagine these guys are just having the time of their lives traveling throughout Europe and playing, you know, in much smaller venues than they're able to play in the United States at this point. And I think it does come through in the music.
Yeah, all those tours, the Europe tours are worth going back to. I think we've had, Matt mentioned the June 97 we did. But you know, you could spend a lot of time going back to these, and even the February 97 and this one, they're just all so, there's so much there, but it's just totally different band, you know, which is fun to go back to. But this is not even fair how ridiculous this ghost is. So up till now, just realizing not to, you know, Livefish is not sponsoring this podcast, but, you know, all six of the shows we've highlighted thus far are available on Livefish. So everyone should go listen to those because sound quality is amazing. We're going to keep going through here to summer 98 in the U.S. I think I put the Riverport 729 show on there just because, again, the gin, you know, opener, first song, 20 minute, made Ben's 20 minute chart. But that, it's one of my favorite jams of all time. But I don't know if the rest of the set really like holds up in the same way that these others do. But I think it's a set that I'll always go back to just because of that jam.
I mean, I think I agree with you that, you know, it's maybe the Camden 99, the Chalk Dust Torture that's near the beginning of that show is kind of in the same category where they just play this unbelievable jam right at the top. And it's like, how do you even live up to that for the rest of the set? But this show, it does have an interesting set list for the rest of the set. I mean, you get some rarities in Dog Log. I guess Ficus wasn't as big of a bust out at that point. But yeah, and then, you know, Vultures, Glide, somewhat rare songs that are popping up in there. So it's good. But obviously, you know, there's no way to to follow that bathtub gin.
Yeah. And I would say, that's maybe another one of those sort of trends among some of these sets is a first set full of rarities, which actually kind of became one of the staples, I feel like, in 3.0 of the Sunday night amazingness. So many of those great Sunday night shows have us, you know, amazing jams in the second set, but a first set full of rarities. And so there's the shock value for you to get everybody kind of on their toes and expecting something. And then of course here you have the 1-2 punch of the amazing gin followed by a whole bunch of rarities. So it's a fun one. This actually might be another one where the first set's a little bit better than the second set, although that Buried Alive jam in the second set, which is just weird, is good too. But, and I will point out, if we're talking about trends, Bathtub Gin from this show, another workout jam for me. Love that funk. Love the funk breakdown.
Same with me.
Yeah, it's a good one. It never lets up. And like, you know, 20 minutes of solid jamming. And we didn't have a lot from the rest of 98, although there are probably, if people out there listening, you have a favorite show that has an awesome first set from fall 98 that maybe we overlooked, let us know. But we sort of ended 98 there. Is there anything we missed in 98 now that we're talking about it?
I really like, I think it's the second night of Deer Creek 98. So that's the show that opens with Rhinoceros,
the Pumpkins cover.
Smashing Pumpkins, which I think is a great cover, and then it's immediately followed by I believe this is another 20-minute jam, but one of the great Halley's Comets of all time.
That's a good call. Yeah, those are good. I'm just sad because I lived close to there at the time and didn't go, so I kind of ignore those shows, but those are good. That's a good point. That's a good call.
You're punishing them.
Yeah, but that's a good point. Those are good show. Those are two nights, Deer Creek?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was August 2nd and 3rd.
All right, guys. So we're moving on to 2000. We completely skipped 99, not because we don't love it, but because by the time this comes out, you'll hear our full discussion of at least the first part of 99, which we went through exhaustively. Exhaustively and funly also, but Ben, you were talking about the 624 2000 show as a highlight in terms of first sets.
Yeah, so this is probably another show that it's fair to say the first set outshines the second. This first set starts out with I think one of the longest moment dances ever. It's about 15 minutes and really worth checking out. A little bit longer than usual Runaway Jim, which is also a strong version. But then, you know, when you're talking about this set, the thing you're really talking about is the Tweezer, which breaks 26 minutes, and it just covers an unbelievable amount of ground. It's, I think, like a real encapsulation of everything that the band was doing well in the summer of 2000. To me, it's an all-timer.
What sticks out to you about the Tweezer? I mean, it covers a lot of ground you mentioned, but what else? Like, what else should people listen for when they go back to that one?
Yeah, I think it's around two-thirds of the way through the jam or something like that. The band has sort of been doing, like, there was a funk section, and then there was sort of like a, you know, everyone plays with their pedals section. And then there's one point at which they start this groove, and I think some people have compared it to I Know You Rider. And it sounds like that for a second, but then it's one of those jams that just that just gets this chord progression. Trey is playing this syncopated guitar line, and it just almost sounds like it's composed, and it sounds unlike any other jam really. And it, you know, they just kind of ride that wave for a good at least 5 minutes, and it's really brilliant stuff.
It's interesting because now, you know, in contrast to what we talked about earlier, which was like shenanigans and, you know, bust outs and other stuff. Now it's just like the last several first sets are just like monster jams, you know, and it, similar to what would anchor a great second set. But this is totally worth going back to. And we as the band did skip from 2000 to 2003. Although we kind of pick it up right at the beginning there at 228 NASA. I mean, we could talk all day about NASA. There's several highlights, but clearly this might be like up there in the top couple first sets, just because of, well, I'll let you guys.
Oh gosh. I mean, I could literally talk for probably days on end about this show. This is a show that where I think I agree it's one of the great first sets of all time, and yet it's a first set that is I think nowhere even close to the second set. But yeah, I mean, you know, this of course the first huge thing that happens at this show is that the second song is Destiny Unbound, which you know, this was at this point by far the biggest bust out in Phish history. Fans had been chanting for it. They had been doing cannibalistic death rituals for it at Hampton 97, and the band finally busted it out. And so, you know, this was destined, no pun intended, to be a really huge show. And then the playing throughout the set just absolutely keeps up with it. So you have, to that point, I think what I would call the best Back on the Train of all time, just a huge jam out of that. And then this bathtub gin that is just absolutely monumental. The band is just, you know, they're at the end of their first tour back from the hiatus, and they're absolutely gelling and firing on all cylinders. And you hear it in every single jam throughout that show.
Yeah, the bathtub gin and the Destiny Unbound, like those two things in combination, just sort of send it over the edge. But also just the jam is really just, it's a wonderful piece of improv, you know, not just the length or the play. It's just, the playing is just wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, not to dwell on it, but the Destiny, I don't know that there's ever been a bigger bust out. I mean, not statistically, because there have been longer gaps of things that have happened, like, you know, or even something like Fuck Your Face that, you know, had never been played live and then started to get played. But, you know, Ben, like you were saying, like, the degree to which people were like campaigning the band to play it for years, and the story at that time was, well, we're, you know, I think somebody had heard from Mike or something and said, like, well, we're never going to play it in again because it sounds too much like the Grateful Dead and that's just not our style. So it was, for all intents and purposes, like a lost song. And I think the feeling, I know, like when I got into the band, and for, you know, then the first four or five years was like, this is just a song that they don't play anymore. It doesn't exist. And, you know, we can say whatever we want to the band. We can campaign them. We can shout things at them, and it's just not going to happen. And then not only did they play it then, it kind of came out of the blue at the start of that set. And now it's become like not a super common song, but they play it relatively regularly. And even Mike started playing it with his band this week. So it's, I don't know, it's come full circle and it's sort of back in the repertoire now. Ben, I liked your comment that, like, as amazing as this first set is, then you get into the second set. And I actually don't even listen to the first set from this show that much, because if I'm going to put it on, I'm going to go straight to the Tweezer. But to take that set out, I mean, it's probably a better first set than many second sets are for a lot of shows.
Yeah.
So we're jumping to 3.0. I think we feel like the Utica show from 2010, you kind of have to mention, just because, again, more antics and shenanigans than huge jams. The Coyote teases in the Bowie and other stuff. I think that is what makes it stand out. But this is really one of the only 3.0 first sets that we highlighted. Cause, I don't know, for me, up through 2016, really, most of the first sets I saw were like fine and fun and pretty great, but like nothing that I would necessarily remember forever. Is that, do you guys feel similarly about that?
Yeah. I mean, to me, I was at this show and I remember feeling like, you know, not only that the first set stood out, but that this was there. It felt like something, like they really crossed a threshold with this show. You know, like this was the first time since they came back that I left the show feeling like, holy shit, like the band just threw down, like they did something really new and really cool. And I was excited about the future of Phish after that show in a way that I hadn't been. And the first set, I think, was probably more responsible for that feeling than the second set was.
I wonder, I'm kind of thinking about that idea of the lead-in, because in this case with Utica, the thing for the show is the guy Yudi teases all over the place, right? And the guy Yudi starts in the first set, so maybe that's, you know, part of the brilliance of the first set is that, you know, the cool callback stuff doesn't wait till the second set, like a tweezer fest or something like that. They kind of get the party going early and have a little bit more fun throughout the whole show instead of just the second set.
Yeah. And it definitely, I think at the time also felt like it was really spontaneous. And you know, whether it's jamming or whether it's some kind of shenanigans, you know, I think there was probably less spontaneity in the first sets at that point. And so it was just kind of extra special that it was even happening at all.
And I will say we would be remiss to not mention the Fuck Your Face show, because that first set is pretty legendary. And I think would, you know, we should just mention that first set is also awesome.
Yeah. And I would, the one thing I would say about that first set is, you know, of course, at the end of it, the band had spelled out "fuck you." And my favorite tidbit about this is that I remember on Twitter there were some people, because this was in the summer of the end of the summer of 2012, right before the presidential election, and when they started I guess it was Runaway Jim that opened the second set. I remember there were multiple people that were tweeting that they were going to spell out "fuck you, Romney," which I think is one of the all-time
that would have been really that would have been really aggressive. That would have been really aggressive.
Probably not quite as cool,
but it's interesting because you think about summer and fall 13, and how much to me that's when like the 3.0 era really solidified. You know, in terms of quality playing, and almost all of those shows, particularly fall 2013, every second set was amazing and every first set was just like fine. You know, there was like a one or two notable pieces, you know, in each first set, but not a lot of shows that really stood out based on a full two set show.
Yeah. I'm actually just looking through what's made the cut for my iTunes library. And from fall of 13, the only set one material that I have is Back in the USSR. And then, and then the theme from 11 2, which is a legitimately great version.
Ben, I guess as a way to sort of wrap up, you know, this discussion, what's your take on where they are now musically and, you know, how that's sort of, What has 2017 meant in terms of Phish, you know, both history but also moving forward? Where I don't know. What are your thoughts on where Phish is right now?
I think that the state of Phish is very good right now. You know, we were talking about early in this discussion about how summer of 97 and 97 generally kind of rewrote the rule book, and I think the Baker's Dozen kind of did the same thing. You know, it really feels like it shook up everything about how Phish makes music, and it, you kind of get the sense that they feel that way, and I think that feeling kind of infused their playing over the New Year's run, which seemed just really inspired. You know, in terms of what that means for first sets, honestly, to me, it seems like everything is on the table. And you know, I would not be surprised if we see lots of huge jams this summer in first sets. I also wouldn't be surprised if we don't, because the fact is, like, you know, I think this band has proven that they continue to have lots of tricks up their sleeves, and they continue to be really creative. And you know, time will tell where that takes them.
And what do you think about like the last few shows? We also, so obviously the jam filled night was something we wanted to highlight, but also the 12:30 show, which Matt and I were both there and has been discussed mightily. But also it's like, I think there's been some pushback in terms of like, will it stand up in the history books, just based on, you know, because of the set list itself of the first set and maybe not necessarily the playing, but what's your take on the playing itself, where they are now, and whether it's, you know, I don't know, where, how do you think they're playing and how the jamming and stuff like that has evolved in this year?
Yeah, it's, I mean, honestly, I think that the thing that I would say about 2017, and I don't think I'm the first person to say this probably even on this podcast, but I think it's probably the most consistently great year that they've had. I mean, honestly, at least since 97, you know, you go through the Baker's Dozen and you don't find any subpar shows. Arguably, you don't find any sub great shows. And, you know, I mean, I think the conversation on Twitter that we were having was about Trey's playing. And I don't think, my personal opinion is that Trey is not, you know, he's not the player that he was in 94 or in 97. And he's never going to be, but that he's still a really creative guitar player. And, you know, and the bandmates that he happens to be blessed with are, continue to get better, I think. I mean, I honestly think that Mike is someone who just has this weird energy that, you know, maybe it's a Benjamin Button thing that makes him just get better and better with age. And the rest of the band, I think, sounds so great. And, you know, and I think as Trey's and Paige's rigs continue to evolve, you know, the sounds that the band is capable of producing continue to evolve. And so, you know, it's, I think that the band is perpetually interesting, and I think that that's only going to grow from here on out.
I think I agree with all of that. And I would add, you know, we talked about this Lawn Boy with Wally, a few months ago. And, I think my comment at that point was that it's hard to judge the impact of the Lawn Boy at this point, because not enough time has passed, not enough shows have happened. And so I'm really looking forward to next summer. It's not surprising that the New Year's run was great. They were still at sort of like, you know, they had that home court advantage that they had all in 2017. And if I commented to somebody after like the first night that I went on the New Year's run, that it just felt like stepping back into the Baker's Dozen again, like the staff, the people, we were still in that familiar routine. So where the rubber hits the road for me is going to be like, what happens next summer when they are playing in a different place every night? When you introduce the factors of, you know, travel and, you know, sleep and all that kind of stuff. Are they going to have the same approach? Are they going to do a little bit more of a reset in each city and kind of try to play a more even keeled show? I don't know. But I think there's no arguing that all of the factors that came together to make 2017 a unique year and way different than any other years in the band's history led to great playing from start to finish.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And Ben, it's like your analysis of sort of the band's evolution musically and where Trey is. I agree with all that. It's interesting to think about how technology and the gear itself and the evolving sound has affected that, you know. At MSG, at least over the New Year's run, Mike's sound was just, it was incredible. And how much of that is his playing versus the way that the sound has evolved is, I have no idea, but man, he sounded outrageous the entire run, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. And, you know, and I think that in terms of Trey's pedals, I mean, cause I think that also obviously had a pretty big impact on the sound of the New Year's run. And I think some people have given him some crap about, you know, his reliance on pedals, which is something that has been true his entire career. I think people have been, you know, since the days of RMP starting threads about Trey laying off the pedal board. But I think that something that he's proven over time is that, you know, the longer he spends with any given pedal, the more he's able to do with it. And so I think that only bodes well for how they're able to jam with his new rig.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. That's a good way to end it, because we'll be able to add a couple more first sets to the list after this summer tour that will or will not, but hopefully will happen.
Let's hope so.
Yeah.
This has been awesome, Ben. Thanks for putting all the work into it and helping us develop this. It was a fun conversation and good to, we actually spanned the entire career of Phish here in this discussion.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much for having me. It's been a blast.
Yeah, thanks for always participating and giving feedback and engaging in conversation too. It's great, great to always chat with you.
Likewise.
And if we don't talk to you, good luck with having a new baby, because it's a lot of fun and a lot of work, I've heard.
Yeah. No, I've heard the same thing.
It's cool. Yeah.
RJ's only judging you because you're not having two at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. All my kids are asleep. I think they're fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, super excited for you. And maybe I'm hoping that maybe I can make a trip out there, because Brad's in Phoenix. Hoping I could come out and catch a couple shows if a West Coast thing happens. So maybe we can meet out there.
Yeah, but, totally.
In the meantime, thanks for joining.
Yeah, no, thank you guys again.
All right. And if you guys want to send us hate mail or Valentine's Day cards, you can email us helpingfriendlypodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet at us or send us Facebook messages or whatever works for you. And yeah, everyone, thanks for listening. And yeah, let us know what you think. Let us know what we missed and other things you would include. Matt, thank you for your brilliant insights.
No problem. I'm going to get back to the pile of episodes that I have to put together.
Matt's just the pile of episodes on top of Matt. All right, guys. Thanks for joining. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Keep on rocking.